This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's show on the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today...
My father was a jeweler. I grew up in his shop, and lighting is considered sort of the jewelry for the home.
We illuminate the work of the husband and wife team behind lighting brand Allied Maker at their Long Island workshop. Plus...
They're all young emerging artists from South Korea, and they use different techniques, but I try to find artists that really complement each other.
Things are hotting up at Design Miami. Our culture editor was at the latest edition of the fair and brings us the highlights from Miami Beach. Plus, we pull on our fatigues and skirmish into the world of military uniforms. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. In the shadow of downtown Manhattan's skyscrapers, an erstwhile dentist's office has been gutted and transformed into a smart showroom for the lighting collection of American design and manufacturing company Allied Maker. All of Allied Maker's items, such as the tricone pendant lamp and celestial alabaster lights, are produced within an hour and a half of Manhattan in the suburban sprawl of Long Island's Glen Cove neighborhood. Monocle contributor Marissa Masria-Katz went to visit Allied Maker's headquarters, which is run by the husband and wife team Lynette and Ryden Rizzo. We hear about their ongoing mission to elevate American craftsmanship and the importance of having a real-life retail space. Hear, hear.
Hi, I'm Ryden Rizzo.
Hi, I'm Lynette Rizzo.
So we're outside your space. How large is the factory?
So we've got about 9,000 square feet here. Here we have, obviously, we're housing finishing, assembly, all of our inventory storage, any of our fabrication that needs to get done, a shipping department. We do our, you know, photography, production planning, all of that kind of stuff within the same building.
Your base is Long Island, which is around an hour or so outside of Manhattan. Why Long Island? Tell me a little bit about the space, how you found it.
So interestingly enough, Glen Cove actually used to be a very big manufacturing hub. The building that we're in used to be an umbrella factory. There was a leather tannery down the street. There used to be a manufacturing hub here in Glen Cove, which died out, I think, probably about 20 years ago. But I think that, you know, as Manhattan becomes more expensive, as Brooklyn becomes more expensive, there's definitely a need for other areas that are good for young people to go and really start their businesses and lives. And I think for us, obviously, Ryden grew up in Long Island, but I decided to move here. I think it was a choice for me because, you know, I love nature and I love the city all the same. So this gave me the perfect balance of both. And here we get this fairly large manufacturing facility for, you know, a fraction of the cost of what it would be in Brooklyn, for example.
Okay, should we go inside?
All right, so first we're going to walk into our metal finishing department. So this is the first space that you walk into, directly into the manufacturing area. And it's where we apply all of our patina metal finishes, as well as do any of our prepping, sanding, and all that type of work. All of our finishes, we consider them to be honest finishes, whereas we're not taking a piece of steel and making it look like a piece of gold. We're taking brass and we're putting on patinas that feel the most organic to the material. Like all of our black finishes are black oxide that we rub on, which you could see Adam doing over here. And if you left a piece of brass out for 100 years, it would develop this black. So we're simply, you know, just making this process in a more controlled, finished look. We hand rub every single piece, as opposed to a lot of black oxide finishes are dunked in these mega baths, and it leads to, you're not really able to fine tune exactly how the sanding pattern comes out.
How did you get into lighting? Was this something that you had studied when you went to Parsons, or was this something completely unexpected for you?
I wouldn't say that it was necessarily unexpected, because looking back on sort of what I studied and how I grew up, it makes perfect sense. My father was, and still is, a jeweler, and I grew up in his shop, and lighting is considered sort of the jewelry for the home. And I was at Parsons, I studied design and technology, and there's definitely a connection to lighting there. More specifically, what I was doing was sort of on the new media installation art side of things, and a lot of my projects involved an element of light, usually mixed in with an element of sound as well.
Take me to the beginnings of the company, how it was formed, how you two met, and what kind of vision you had for it.
I was very inspired by maker culture at the time. I was just looking at like leather making blogs, people making knives, woodworking, whatever it was. I just thought it was cool. And I just said, you know, I want to just do a project where I make two new things a week. And I'll just go to my garage and I'll just make things. And that's how it started. And I made a cheese spreader, a cutting board. I worked myself up to furniture. And then I fell in love with it. And I decided to, after school, I did a course in Vermont where you stay with this guy and you build a guitar for 2 months from scratch. And I did that, and that totally changed me, because when I got back home, I just had this addiction to the workshop. You know, waking up, having your coffee, going into a dusty shop, and just being able to make something that was physical, real, and really satisfying. And I think that continues to this day. Like, for me, Allied Maker, the goal for me is to have a good workshop. That's my inspiration.
And how did lighting come about? Because it sounds like you've gone through a lot of different experiences in terms of making things. So why and how did you settle on lighting?
Lighting came about when I made my first lamp. It was a very simple piece of lighting. It was literally a block of wood with a brass socket in it and one of those filament bulbs, you know, what you see on Etsy every day.
Tell me a little bit about who's buying the product right now and what are some of the specific pieces that are really attractive perhaps to different parts of the world.
People that are purchasing our lights are sort of looking for this very contemporary new American feel. We're taking a lot of our designs are, you know, sort of inspired by a lot of things, but then we're transforming it to create this new wave of American culture. We also went to Bentonville, Arkansas. And, you know, these places are like the heartland of America. And we were so humbled by everything new had sort of an Allied Maker feel to it. And a lot of our fixtures, we, unbeknownst to us, had been shipping out there. A few restaurants that have our fixtures. And we were just so humbled by these true American towns that are, they're little design hubs. And who would know it? Who would think that these little towns are just totally transformed?
So this is our fabrication department. Here we have a Bridgeport lathe, manual mill, tapping arm, cold saw, drill press. And this is where, you know, if you look at our lighting collection, you're going to see a lot of bent tubes. You're going to see arcs, and you're going to see precisely machined hardware that joins everything together. And this is where most of it is made, at least the parts that we do in-house, which is a lot of bending, tapping, and machining. And then we work with local vendors in Long Island and Brooklyn and New Jersey.
But specifically, we work with artisan manufacturers. So it'll be people that definitely have an eye for it, that are doing specialty manufacturing runs. We want each one of our pieces, whether, you know, it's one or 2,500, to feel special and unique. And we want, you know, the attention to detail to really be there.
Wood finishing carries the same principles as metal finishing. We're not covering anything up to look like a different wood or staining things in a specific way. We're applying oiled finishes on walnut. We're bleaching walnut and oak to desaturate the color. And we're applying an oxide finish onto oak to give it a natural dark look.
So here we have assembly. We're working on an order of ADA flush sconces, part of our alabaster collection. Anthony's wiring the pieces and they've been finished, so hopefully we'll get to dispatch these in the next day.
What would you say is the most popular piece that you're producing these days, and how do you see the market sort of changing and evolving since you've started?
I think we have two competing collections that for sales are definitely the art collection. We have so many variants and it really allows it to be customizable for your space. You can change the dome size, you can change the finish to whatever finish you'd like. You can have a metal dome, a glass dome, a perforated dome. It really allows you to personalize it. And then there's nothing that beats just like a beautiful little sconce or mini orb is just, I mean, it's perfect for anything.
Let's talk very briefly about the new space in Tribeca and what was the impetus behind opening something like that. How necessary is it to have an actual space, a retail space?
Our product gets purchased and placed in thousands of different projects, but very rarely do we get to see our collection pieces together. You know, we see them in the shipping area, we see them in the testing area, we obviously develop all of the pieces, but to curate a story, you know, to kind of select certain pieces and then put them into an environment that feels, I think that we went in a very sort of serene direction in the showroom. We wanted it to feel reflective, like a space where, you know, the light speaks for itself. There's lots of desaturated colors. The floor is desaturated. Even the architecture, the arcs that we used, it was to soften the space. It's got this very meditative feel. We wanted to see what that felt like also. There was a joke in the early days, like, where did the lamps go? And we finally got to give the lamps a home.
As soon as we were finished setting it up, and for the first time we got to stand in the space with everything complete and all the lighting fixtures up, Lynn and I both looked at each other and were like, whoa. You know, we've never seen our pieces together in a space before that we've curated.
Yeah, and we were looking at it in CAD drawings and we're just like, this is going to be awesome. But that moment of really standing there for the first time and, you know, having our logo on the floor and like really seeing the pieces together, I think was really just illuminating.
Thanks to Marissa Masria-Katz reporting there from Long Island. Stick around. Next up, we're donning our fatigues and skirmishing into the world of army uniforms. Do stay with us. In an address to the European Parliament last month, German Chancellor Angela Merkel announced her support for the creation of a new European army to help NATO forces. It'll still be a while before a new European army gets its marching orders, if it does at all. And before that, decisions would need to be made. Who would pay for it? Where would it be headquartered? Where would its soldiers hail from? And crucially, what would these cadets be wearing? Contributor Alex Masakis is a journalist and the former editor of various design publications. We gave him the task of dreaming up what such a uniform might look like.
For hundreds of years, military uniforms have expressed the identities of the nations they represent. Historically, they've been deployed to construct specific narratives, that a country is all-powerful, or cultured and refined, or just plain rich, with resources to burn. A few centuries ago, European uniforms were often brightly coloured. Some were red with contrasting turnbacks, others yellow or green, colours that hinted at faraway exploits. And they were ornate. This was when soldiers still wore gilt-braided waistcoats, when helmets incorporated enormous feathers, when military coats had love affairs with metallic buttons. Much of the decoration was pragmatic then. Braiding protected the torso. Later, a button might be used as extra ammunition should the bullets run out. Today, ordinary duty uniforms tend towards the drab because it makes sense economically mostly, and in modern military mode, nobody really needs gilt braiding anymore. For the past 150 years, uniform designers have embraced functional monotony. Greys, greens, dark blues, khakis, standard camouflage patterns, straightforward cuts, uncomplicated fabrics. And because overt displays of military power have long been considered crude and kind of hostile, modern uniforms more commonly resemble civilian clothing. They're simple and comfortable, pragmatic and relatively inexpensive. A stripe might run along the outer seam of a trouser leg. A jacket might feature the odd fool's pocket, but that's your decorative lot. So a uniform worn by a new European army should probably follow suit. This will be a functional venture, after all, and not just for show, though it will likely be loaded with symbolism. Here's an opportunity to showcase the Union's aspirations, to be seen as self-reliant, smart and progressive, to display solidarity, a representation of a tolerant Europe never more united, integrated and collectively capable, as nationalism again sweeps across the world. That's an awful lot of symbolism for designers to pack into a single outfit. But they might start by dealing with colour and look to Europe's landscapes for inspiration. To the forest greens of Bavaria, or the greys and whites of the French Alps, or the deep blues of the Mediterranean. A combination might work best, to represent a kind of unity. Tasteful tones, nothing too showy. These are colours that have precedent in contemporary military design. Sections of the Greek army wear dark olive green with bright blue caps. Elements of the French military, which once wore all white, wear a rich and elegant navy blue. And following tradition, the Germans wear a heap of grey, a colour that in Britain might be named Oxford grey, though it won't be called that in this context, what with Brexit. In light of the weather, layers seem crucial. There should be long coats for soldiers deployed in the north or the mountains. Short-sleeve button-ups for those further south. There need be enough pockets for contemporary tech. Decorative details could reference the EU flag in the form of gold stars, symbols of unity. And as a highlight, soldiers might borrow from the Franco-German Brigade, whose members sometimes wear a delicate yellow neck scarf. When Trump was elected, he made a show of ensuring all American military uniforms be made in America, though it was later reported that a large amount of US apparel was produced in Mexico, El Salvador and Honduras. You'd imagine Europe's leaders would prefer their uniforms be made in Europe by European firms out of European materials. Merino from Spain, cotton from France or Portugal. Better to reinvest than to outsource. A major military contract would generate jobs and ensure sustainable production. That leaves the EU with a uniform that is refined and functional, local and hard-wearing, with few thrills but a deep sense of pragmatism, geography and belonging. Only a stronger Europe is going to defend Europe, Angela Merkel said last month. The uniform its new army wears will be designed to represent that strength.
Our very special thanks to Alex Moussakis there for indulging our whimsy and talking us through what a European army uniform might look like. As design fairs multiply around the world, sometimes it can be difficult for a gallery to decide what location to pick and where's best to show off its wares. Despite being relatively small, or perhaps thanks to its manageable size, Design Miami, which wrapped up over the weekend, has a strong identity that attracts a specific kind of sun-seeking visitor. The fair takes place concurrently with Art Basel Miami Beach. This proximity to its artsy neighbour gives it an edge over many other design fairs. Most of the exhibitors in the tent are in fact galleries displaying one-off designs by modernist masters or contemporary artists. The furniture, vases and lamps on display straddle that ever so fine line between art and design and are usually nabbed by collectors rather than shops or drop-ins. The fair therefore opens up a few interesting questions on the difference and similarities between art and design. Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Rimella, went along and brings us this report.
The beginning of December in Miami is known as Art Week. Art Basel Miami Beach attracts collectors from around the world to these sunny, sandy shores. The art fair comes accompanied by a number of side events. Many visitors refer to Design Miami as one of those satellite fairs. Compared to its big-box behemoth of a neighbour, Design Miami definitely feels smaller, but in its approach, it isn't derivative. Instead, the influence of the art fair next door adds an interesting angle to proceedings. Pierre-Marie Giraud is a dealer specialising in decorative contemporary art, who's decided to pitch up a spot for his Brussels-based gallery inside this design fair.
I have always thought this proximity with art is great for us and it's great for art also to others. I think it's the dialogue between design, furniture, objects and paintings and sculpture is great. And I think a great artist is great whatever he does. Quality stands in design and in art. It's not a matter of being a painter or being a craft maker which counts. It's the quality you're making from what you know, what you're capable of, your inventivity, your creativity, your genius if you have some. So that's something I have to say is very important for me. This proximity is also a bit dangerous in some ways. I feel sometimes we see in the art world things which I think belong to the design world, and the opposite is true. This flirting, I can see that in ceramic actually, I'm a ceramic dealer. Those artists who flirt between sculpture and decorative arts and who try to get into the art world in order to get maybe more audience or more credibility. For me, that's something I don't feel totally comfortable with.
Can we go into the booth and can you talk to us about some of the pieces that you're showing today? If there's like any standouts that you would like to highlight for us, and also how you go about making a selection for Miami, you know, when you put your Miami thinking cap on, what kind of considerations go into that?
In Miami, I try to show all the artists we have at the gallery. It's important for me. It's another part of the world. You know, when I show in Basel, for example, when I show at the gallery, we do personal exhibition every month at the gallery. It's different. Miami, I want people from all over the world, I mean, from this part of the world, to understand what we do in Belgium, concentrated in 1 week on one booth. So I would say maybe a busy dialogue between all these artists working with ceramic, glass, bamboo, lacquer from some of them. But I try always to tell a story. This year we are playing a lot with colors, for example with Jos de Vrint lamps. He's a Belgian designer based in Ghent, and we've been working with Jos for a very long time now, so it's, I think, a very beautiful selection of his lamps. Also a beautiful selection of Japanese designers working with glass, like for example Yoichi Ohira, you see those two vases. Also Ritsue Mishima, the beautiful transparent glaze vase you see here. But also working with ceramic, like Takuro Kuwata, Japanese artist based in Kyoto. And if you look at what Takuro does today, related to the work of Sterling Ruby, for example, Sterling is based in Los Angeles, Takuro is based in Kyoto, and they speak together, they communicate together. They're not linked in any way, in any case, one to each other, but their work, through their work, they establish a communication. So that's what I want to show in this presentation. All over the world, you have artists working with different material, with different inspiration, but the dialogue is possible.
A short walk away inside the pavilion, Curimanzutto is a Mexico-based gallery that is making its debut this year at Design Miami, but that has long held a booth inside Art Basel next door. I spoke to the gallery's Fatima Gonzalez about the different offerings Curimanzutto has chosen for the two different fairs and why it has decided to venture into design.
This is an exhibition of Oscar Hagerman, who is a Mexican architect and designer, and this is part of a bigger exhibition we had during the summer in Curimanzutto in Mexico City. Curimanzutto is a contemporary art gallery, so it was the first time we presented design. It was an exhibition on chairs based on the Arrullo design from 1969. This was one of Oscar's first designs, and it was based on the vernacular country simple chair. He perfected it and worked on it with a workshop of carpenters in Mexico City. And then this chair, which we have here, was reintroduced to many workshops. So he sort of gave back the design in order for carpenters and artisans to develop it and reproduce it. This selection, or these chairs, is sort of the result of more than 50 years of work, of developing. So these are all variations that come from the Arrullo chair.
Where does the line between design and art exist?
I think the line is very, very clear here. I mean, this is new for us. It's design, but it's also, Oscar works with many, many communities of artisans in Mexico. And Monica and Jose are big promoters of Mexican design in general. So we do art, but we're always looking out for new things, new young designers, and especially because we think it's very important to preserve all these beautiful techniques, artisanal techniques and materials. It's always in thinking of collaboration, but respecting each other's discipline.
Chairs, cabinets and furniture can easily be categorized as design, but when it comes to handmade ceramics, definitions can get harder. Jörg Lohmann is the owner of J. Lohmann Gallery in New York City. He relocated from Germany to the US 25 years ago, and his love of art led him to open a gallery that specialized in ceramics. This is his first outing at Design Miami, and he chose a particularly eye-catching presentation to introduce his artists to a completely different audience.
This is our first year at Design Miami, and we wanted to come up with like a very unique concept to make a good curated first impression to the audience, you know, especially at Design Miami. So last year we started to work with one artist from South Korea working with ceramic, and then the idea, the Design Miami came up, you know, we were accepted to the fair. I thought it might be a wonderful idea to create a group, to put a group together of several artists working all in the same medium and curate a collection for, especially for this Design Miami fair. So all artists made new pieces just for this fair, and they're all like young emerging artists from South Korea, and but the way they use different techniques, but I try to find artists that really complement each other.
Why did you choose Design Miami? What is, I think, do you think interesting about this location? And, you know, you obviously said choosing a South Korean kind of debut would stand out. Do you think that the fair is evolving towards perhaps attracting different kinds of interest for different kinds of designs and traditions of design?
So Design Miami is one of the most important design fairs in the world. And I always wanted to do a show in Florida, but it has to be the right one. And Design Miami was the only show I wanted to do, because it's a platform for the highest level of design, but also a very good platform to introduce new artists, because the audience is from all over the country, from all over the world.
Design lovers and art collectors are just as attracted to Design Miami. Fairs nowadays have all to gain from mixed pulling power and a little added edge. From Monocle in Miami Beach, I am Chiara Rimella.
Our sincere thanks to Chiara Rimella, Monocle's culture editor, reporting from Design Miami, which wrapped up over the weekend. And it's with regret that that's all we have time for on this week's show. Don't forget that if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can enjoy the fruits of our toil in the form of the Monocle Winter Weekly Newspaper, a fabulous seasonal and chilly new publication that is on newsstands every Thursday in December. You can also delve into the design pages of Monocle magazine, or why not crack the spine of one of the many books we also publish in collaboration with Gestalten. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis, edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans and the decidedly diligent Cassie Galpin. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.